I think that there's a lot of wantrepreneurs. So these are the folks that at the bar will tell me, I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking about that. And trust me, I've been there as well. But at some point, you go from wanting to just doing.
This is Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, a podcast that explores why Montana leads the nation in entrepreneurship and business startups. I'm Arnie Sherman. Michael Braun is the epitome of the eclectic entrepreneur, a private equity financier, startup consultant, cryptocurrency trader, tenured university professor, and author of textbooks on business strategy. Michael has his finger on the pulse of trends influencing the business world. Today on Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, we'll discuss what is essential for businesses to know in order to succeed in today's complex environment. This show is made possible with support from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
For our listeners, I'm going to take the liberty of summing up a little bit more about your background, because to me, it is not only remarkable, it's awe-inspiring, actually. Michael is a professor at the University of Montana College of Business. He speaks four languages. He went to Cornell and got a degree in Asian Studies. He went to USC and got an MBA. He went to NYU and got a master's degree in publishing and media. He went to University of Massachusetts Amherst and got a PhD in management. He's written children's book. He has a textbook that is used at many universities. He just wrote a very interesting article called The Extinction of Michael Braun, which we'll talk about later and find out what that's all about. Plays the ukulele and fly fishes and has a wife and four kids. It really is remarkable to me. So I just wanted our listeners to know that about you as we begin, that it's not just you're a professor, you know, sitting behind a podium, you know, lecturing students. You have a very broad and deep background. So let me just begin by talking about, what is the status of entrepreneurship in Montana now?
Well, first of all, thanks, Arnie. I think you should be my PR person. You might make me sound so good. So yeah, I've been here 12 years and my wife, Daphne, grew up here. That's how I ended up here in Montana. So I started coming here in 1997. In Montana, what I've seen over, I would say the last 20 years, and especially since I've been here full time, is just sort of a different or a changing scene of entrepreneurship. I would tell you that there was a real pulse that started probably about 10 years ago after the housing crisis. So what we ended up seeing is a lot of folks who decided to come out of sort of primary markets, right? And they got either bumped out or they just sort of lost the taste for the rat race. And they brought both their intellectual and social capital. And they started these businesses, the ones that you've actually had on your show, like Submittable or Illuminad and Vim and Vigor and so on and so forth, right? And that's really when here in Montana, we started to get businesses that could compete nationwide, if not internationally as well. And it also started attracting the attention of venture capitalists. I started getting calls from VCs, venture capitalists, or institutional investors from outside of the state interested in actually making investments in these types of companies. So that was sort of the first phase, but I'd like to tell you a little bit about the one that I anticipate now that I'm really excited about.
And what's that?
That one is the huge tidal wave of family businesses that are run by baby boomers that don't have a successor in place.
Right, their kids don't want to go in their parents' business.
Their kids don't want to get in there, or they don't have kids, and they're kind of saying, oh, wow, we've been running this business for 20, 30, 40 years. What do we do? And these are great businesses. Maybe they're not as sexy as sort of the, you know, the high-tech startups, but maybe they're like an air conditioning servicing company or environmental
dry cleaner,
so on and so forth. Great revenues, stable cash flows. They have a good, solid client base. And, you know, here are the statistics, Arnie. We're looking at 10,000 baby boomers retiring every day, right? 70% of those are actually owners or involved in small businesses. So you can quickly sort of do the math and say to yourself, wow, so it is a huge problem that these businesses don't have anybody to take over, but there are younger generations that can come in, they can take these businesses over, and they can infuse them with new management skills, with technology, and really continue that legacy of the family business.
So then what's your angle on this? What are you going to do to participate in this sector?
You know, the question is, what am I not going to do, right? So over the last 12 years, I mean, I've already been intimately involved with family businesses. That kind of harkens back to what I used to do in investment banking. I actually bought and sold family-owned businesses. And I often saw when I was working with family-owned businesses versus non-family businesses that there was always sort of, I don't know, this sort of qualitative difference, right? There was always something that entered the conversation that was a little bit different. We call that familiness, right? Mm-hmm. And it could be a good thing. It could also be a challenging thing. So I've been working with family businesses here for the last 12 years. I've done seminars here. I've done workshops, not just here in Montana, but nationwide as well. But at this point now, I really want to get involved in helping these businesses make that transition to the next generation.
So are the businesses that would come across your desk, mm-hmm. ones in which if someone doesn't intervene like you, they're just going to disappear?
Oh, yeah. And you know what that means for the state of Montana? They disappear. Obviously, it means that jobs disappear. You know, maybe they get transitioned outside of the state. So I think it's actually imperative that we try to keep these businesses here. And the way to do that, we do have some institutional money that is starting to, quote unquote, sniff around, you know, actually building funds. And I'm in talks with those folks. Also, the lenders are becoming aware of that. And again, sure, there is sort of that quantitative aspect where you give them the hard skills to do that. But it's really also the soft skills to hold the hands of the families as they make that transition out of their business. And that ownership goes into new hands.
So does the current state of business education at the university level teach the skills that are necessary to take over this kind of responsibility?
Up to a point. I think, again, the hard skills are there. And obviously, when you're talking also in terms of HR management, but the real focus on what it means to be a family business, right? And how they prioritize different things. They have, for instance, you know, for a family business, it's very important that obviously if their name is in the business, that there's a real feeling of trust, that the brand resonates in the community because the brand is an extension of that family, right? So it's some of these things that you need to be aware of. And we're actually doing some workshops. We're doing some training. This is something that at least I do in my classes to make students aware that this is a terrific opportunity for them. Entrepreneurship doesn't mean that you have to start the next Facebook. It can also mean that you buy an existing business with cash flows. You go to the bank and they basically give you a loan against the assets and you're off and running.
Right. And then you can apply some of the new technologies mm-hmm. to that business and make it more competitive in the business landscape.
You bet.
So talking about that, I was drawn to your article I mentioned, The Extinction of Michael Braun.
Yeah.
Tell our listeners about that article. By the way, for our listeners, the article had a picture of a dodo bird with Michael Braun's face, which was frightening enough in and of itself. But the article was you know, very interesting. And will you explain it to us?
Sure, sure. And I think, you know, there was some soul searching going on there. I mean, like I said, I've been at the university for 12 years. I think I dropped into it quite by accident. I mean, I was in industry. I never thought I'd be an academic. And I see myself as a practitioner scholar. So somebody who has, you know, one foot in industry and the other one in academia. Obviously, it's been a challenging time to be at the University of Montana as it goes through its transition. Now, I would tell you that what we're going through at the University of Montana is not unique to the University of Montana. It is a phenomenon that is hitting a lot of universities nationwide.
And that phenomenon is what?
And what we're talking about is, what does education mean? What is the value proposition? What is the value offering to today's and tomorrow's students, right? Because right now we're still operating in a business model or a model that harkens back, you know, to the Middle Ages, where you had one person who knew how to read and you had one book and that person was disseminating this information. Well, nowadays, if you want information, it's available at the touch of a button. So what does that mean about the role of the teacher, the professor, if you will, and what does it mean for the student, how they learn, the conditions under which they learn, the time span? Does it really mean that you, as a student, you have to go to school for 4 years to get an education? Does it take 4 years for your knowledge to be fully baked out? Or can you kind of disambiguate that educational process and access it when you need it throughout your lifetime?
Well, you bring up an important point. We're offering it in the same time span as it's been offered since universities began.
You bet. Yeah.
And, you know, with artificial intelligence, with, you know, the availability of information instantaneously, with Alexa or Bixby or Watson available to you. I heard a conversation yesterday in Savannah, Georgia, where some lawyers were talking about Watson putting them out of business.
Right. So you do have, you have artificial intelligence, you have machine learning, right? So some of those quantitative skills are being taken over by machines that can do it better and faster and more accurately, right? That's number one. I think number two is also that we have a very competitive field when it comes to education. I mean, the for-profit world has really sort of taken a leap forward through online education where they get very skill specific. So companies like Skillshare, even LinkedIn obviously now offers courses that are very specific when it comes to, for instance, technology certification, if I want to get Six Sigma or if I wanted to know how to use Salesforce, whatever it is. So in that case, that gap between learning and doing is closing, and we have to figure out as professors and as academic institutions how to kind of oscillate between the two, right? The other thing is when you look at today's generation, first of all, I think this is the first generation that on average will actually hit 100 years of age. Now, that means that they're going to have at least five, if not six, seven, eight different careers. So there's going to be a continuous learning process. It's not that you say, well, here's your undergraduate education, vaya con Dios, right? They're going to have to come back throughout that because they're going to have different careers that need new skills. And in that case, it becomes almost more like a subscription model for universities.
Sure. Well, not only are they going to have multiple careers, but the availability and the adaptation to being your own sole source provider in which you work out of your home and you could have multiple employers at the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
I noticed in some of the companies we've interviewed, they don't really care if their employees work a 9-to-5 day or come in 5 days a week, as long as the tasks that they're assigned are, you know, completed during a time period that's acceptable to the employer. It's really a totally changing environment.
Yeah, the worker nomads, right?
Right, worker nomads.
So you become sort of the company of one. It's like Mike Inc. or Arnie Inc., right? And we have to put in the resources ourselves to keep ourselves pretty competitive in a marketplace that, you know, increasingly is shying away from employee loyalty. It becomes a very free market and efficient market.
Right, right. Let me add this. The other layer that always seems to have a profound effect on this is the advancement of technology. We talked about Watson and Alexa, but I'm looking at blockchain technology, which I know you've spent some time taking a look at. What really does that mean? How is it going to impact business, applying blockchain technology to businesses?
Oof. You know, when I think of blockchain, you know, it's one of those words that gets thrown about quite a bit. I think it's harder to operationalize because right now we're still in this experimental phase. But here's blockchain. It's basically a distributed data network that allows you to have data across the network in an open ledger system so nobody can mess with it, basically, right? So think of Google Docs. If you're using Google Docs, for instance, and you're making changes, whoever's invited on that will see that as well. I can give you an example here. So when we look at the global wine industry, we're looking at a $100 billion industry where 20% of wines are counterfeit. With blockchain, you can actually make sure that you're going to drastically reduce the counterfeit of wines throughout the system. So blockchain really goes to some of the issues, some of the shortcomings that we've had with Internet 1.0, even 2.0. Some call blockchain Internet 3.0. Mm-hmm. It's an evolution that attends to some of the shortcomings that we've had in terms of distrust about how our information is being used, right? The lack of transparency. Where does this information come from? Who actually put it out there? So it's all of these things that blockchain at that philosophical level is attending to. And now you do have companies that are actually working on projects to address some of these shortcomings in business.
Sure. And I've seen, and we've talked about it before, blockchain technology being applied in other industries.
Yeah.
And even in, you know, and even social contract kind of relationships.
Right.
Not-for-profit arena.
Yeah.
So there's a lot going on with all of this. You're consulting with small companies, with young entrepreneurs. What do you think they need to know now if you're launching a business? What's important to pay attention to?
Okay. So in general, are we talking?
Yeah, or? Just in general. I walk in the door, I say I'm starting a new business in Billings, Montana. It's going to provide software services to the oil industry. I know about the technology. I don't know about running businesses. What do I need to know?
Yeah. No, I think that's great. I mean, I really try to do that in my classroom and also with my clients, is to get them to think in terms of business models. And what do I mean by that? Well, listen, it's pretty easy to start a business. You and I can incorporate here in the next 15 minutes and put out a shingle and then that's it. But it's really the scaling that becomes quite difficult, quite challenging for companies. So I like what David Packard of HP said when he said, you know, most companies in the growth phase die of indigestion, not starvation.
Mm-hmm.
What he meant by that is it's really difficult for companies that are in growth mode to focus on what they shouldn't do rather than what they should do. They need a very defined business model that says, okay, here's what we're offering and here's who we're offering it to. And as they're doing that, they create a pretty defined, what I call a box of strategic priorities and their circle of competence to kind of pursue those things on an ongoing basis rather than spread themselves too thin. So I think, you know, for anybody who's thinking about starting a business, it's so easy to be reactive, to have customers come to you and say, can you do this? Can you do that? And so on and so forth. Next thing you know, you're spreading yourself too thin with your resources in terms of capital, in terms of time, in terms of employees. Really know what your business model is, and then go execute, execute, execute.
We're talking with Mike Braun today, professor from the College of Business at the University of Montana, about current trends and future directions in business. You consult with Montana companies, companies around the United States, and international companies as well. Can you compare and contrast? Are there significant differences when you're doing work with an Italian company versus an American company?
Oh, yeah. I think at least the work that I've done in Italy is with companies looking to obviously access the American market because, you know, Italy's very sort of a very difficult economic landscape. You have a lot of different regions with different laws. It's very difficult to actually even start a business, to go through all that red tape, through that bureaucracy, if you will. And then, of course, if you are a company in Italy, then you think, well, you know, Europe is my marketplace, but what does that mean? Now you have 26 different countries with different languages, with different standards, whereas in the US, you have a unified market of 330 million customers, one language. Yes, there might be little tweaks state to state, but from sea to shining sea, you have a sort of an integrated logistical and marketing and sales infrastructure that you can tap.
And as you talk to both American and international entrepreneurs, when you're asked to help somebody, there's usually an event that precipitates their coming to meet with you.
Yeah.
Are there common problems you're seeing?
Well, you know, I think here's where I come in. Here's sort of my role, if you will, especially for companies that are looking at sort of their next phase of growth. they're working in the business. They need somebody to help them work on the business, right? So, you know, they get up in the morning, they go to work, and then they're already putting out fires, being responsive to customer needs, et cetera, et cetera. But once in a while, you got to stand back and ask yourself, why? Why are we doing what we're doing? What are we trying to accomplish? You know, what is the strategic intent of this company as we go forward? So I really help them refine that. I'm as intrigued by corporate turnaround situations. I work quite a bit with those kinds of situations when I was back in my investment banking days, but I do that now as well. And this is where companies have fallen so far inside of themselves that they've lost traction with customers. They've actually lost sight of who their customers are, how maybe the customer purchases and behaviors have shifted on them. And then it's really going back to the drawing board and saying, how do we create a compelling value proposition or offering that reconnects to the existing customers or then plugs into a next customer segment that will ride the wave for that company for years to come?
Is it easy to identify companies that have that failing?
You know, I think I have been honing that, right? And it's also at the MBA level, that's what my course is on. It's on corporate turnaround. So, you know, we do have a set of tools that helps us, first of all, get the conversation going, because it's a conversation that a lot of managers and then sort of stakeholders don't want to have. They don't want to admit that, you know, they've fallen short, that they've lost touch with customers, that they've lost their competitive footing. So first of all, it's sort of making that explicit, and then also making them aware of some of their own blinders that have led them to this. A lot of it actually deals with psychology. And you know, in that case, I also come in as a coach to help top management really overcome some of those blinders, to open their world perspective and to get them thinking in an innovative fashion.
So you're immersed in the current trends in business and entrepreneurship. You're a professor teaching. Tell me about your children's book. How did that come about?
I guess I get bored pretty quickly, so I always have to have a lot of different projects going. The book is called The Fantastic Birthday Cake Story, and it was a story that I told my oldest daughter, Madeline, when she was a child. She would always ask me, you know, make up a story, and I would tell this one among others, but this one was the one that she kept coming back to. And then we ended up having three additional kids, beautiful kids, all four of them. But that story kind of stuck, and I would tell the rest of them. I think maybe it was also nostalgia at some point where I said, you know, I'd like to capture that story in a book. And I was fortunate enough to have my niece, Elena Malerba, who's Italian. She's an illustrator. And we said, why don't we get together and, you know, I'll write the story and you do the illustrations. And lo and behold, we have
That's a children's book.
Book.
So with all of these things going on and the fact that you get bored easily, what do you read that keeps you current on what's going on?
Let's call it my dojo. My strategy and business model dojo is the markets. So, you know, first thing I do in the morning is I check the markets. I check CNBC. I track a certain number of companies. Some of them I've tracked for over a decade. And I see what they're doing, really what the result of their strategic decisions are, right? So I look at that. I get Business Week. I think that is a great quick read that can address both strategy and business model issues. I think there's also the qualitative side that I'm really into. So right now, I do read Tony Robbins' work. I'm big into executive coaching, into sort of the qualitative elements that can unleash the power of top management and employees. You know, I read a variety of works out there that really go central to how to make a healthy organization.
So what should young entrepreneurs pay attention to in the coming years?
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's a constantly shifting landscape. Obviously, the power of the internet now when we're looking at blockchain, I think they need to be aware of the impact or the continuing impact of technology on businesses. I do think that more and more, it is a focus on managing people. That will separate the good enough companies from the great companies out there. How you manage your employees, how you get them, how you source them, how you train them, how you compensate them. Because with millennials, what I see is that, you know, their sort of lifestyle priorities are different than the ones that you and I grew up with that we wanted. Yeah, maybe if earlier generations had more of a job security, now we're talking about work-life balances, right? There's a bigger sort of consciousness to what is happening outside of the family, outside of the community. So businesses have to have a sort of a bigger worldview of what their purpose is on the planet, if you will. So I think that one is going to be a very important consideration for entrepreneurs when they build their teams.
Is there a company that you see now that does it right?
I think that the companies that stand out for me, I mean, I think Zappos, what Tony Hsieh has done and continues to do with Zappos is pretty incredible. I look at Trader Joe's. Trader Joe's has been, you know, around since the 50s in a highly competitive marketplace where you go up against the Walmarts of the world. And the way that they've been able to do it from the ground up, the way that they treat their employees, all the way to how they treat their customers and how they really keep a focus centrally on their value proposition is pretty amazing. I think Costco is another one in that sector that really puts the customer first and the employees at the same time, knowing that if you treat your employees well, your customers will be taken care of. And then Jeff Bezos is just a master at this. He always says, start with a customer and work backwards.
So you've touched on this, but let me get a little bit deeper. What drives Michael Braun?
You know, I think the words that come to mind are discovery, diversity, challenge, a better tomorrow, whatever that might entail. But I think maybe it's an age thing, but I'm looking for personal growth. And I think that there are just so many exciting things happening, even here in Montana, that, you know, I want to be a part of. Whether it's at the university, whether it's in the entrepreneurial environment, whether it's in the financial environment, but there are so many challenges that are just waiting to be embraced.
Well, I know there's one thing you and I have in common among several things,
yeah.
But we were both captivated and intrigued with the TV series Mad Men. For me, it was the beginning of the businessman in America to me.
Right.
Right. And what did you find interesting, particularly in comparison to the way business runs today, about watching the 1960s and how business was run then?
Having grown up in a family where my father was a corporate man, there were defined roles, and these have even been documented in books, where there was a specific role in a male-dominated world, and women, and in this case it was, could also see it in terms of the role that my mother adopted, there was a certain role that you occupied in developed countries. I think that has been completely fractured, right? So it's both in terms of sort of supply and demand. I mean, you do have to have, in a lot of households, both partners going and making a living. But then it's also that both partners want to find fulfillment. And it becomes a dance that you have to learn how to do together in the household and outside of that, just to balance all of these sort of different tensions that can arise. But it can also be a beautiful thing.
Last question for you. What advice would you give a young entrepreneur now who's looking at getting into business? You know, is there a kernel of wisdom that you would share, or you consistently share with people, to kind of separate the wheat from the chaff?
I guess I'll invoke the Nike slogan, just do it, right? I think that there's a lot of wantrepreneurs. So these are the folks that at the bar will tell me, I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking about that. And trust me, I've been there as well. But at some point, you go from wanting to just doing. Now, that doesn't mean that you do recklessly. You have to have a guiding framework, and you've try to test and validate and experiment what you think are sort of, you know, your hypotheses about will the dogs eat the dog food, right? But just go do it.
And on that note, Mike Braun, who epitomizes to me the Renaissance entrepreneur, it's been a pleasure talking with you. We can go on for hours, but that'll be for a future installment at some point.
Ditto, Arnie. Thank you so much for having me.
I appreciate you listening to Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, produced by Autumn Barnes and Beth Ann Austin in association with Montana Public Radio. For comments, recommendations for future guests, or general information, please go to mtpr.org. There you can also find previous guest contact information and content from all our shows. Once again, I'm Arnie Sherman wishing you peace and prosperity. This show is made possible with support from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.